This is The Guardian.
Hi, it's Nord Haidar here, coming to you from Gadigal land. Just over 2 weeks ago, Israel launched a deadly strike on an Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria. Iran vowed to retaliate, and on Saturday night it took action, sending hundreds of drones and missiles towards Israel. It is the first time that Iran has attacked Israel directly. In this episode of our global news podcast, Today in Focus, The Guardian's senior foreign correspondent, Emma Graham-Harrison, explains why, despite Israel emerging unscathed, the situation could spiral out of control. Here's Emma.
I was woken up at about 1:30. There'd been a massive explosion that woke up a lot of people. And then we heard the air raid sirens.
On Saturday night, Emma Graham-Harrison, The Guardian's senior international affairs correspondent, was in her hotel room in Jerusalem when Iran launched an unprecedented attack.
So I went to go down to the air raid shelter, and on the way, you could see the sky was full of sort of these arcing bits of air defences intercepting ballistic missiles.
She had known that day that something was going to happen. There had been weeks of speculation and increasingly urgent warnings.
The Israeli military put out a notice that they'd banned all public gatherings for 2 days, that they'd be closing down educational activities. And it became clear that this potential attack that people had been worrying about for several days was becoming more and more of a reality. But we still didn't know what form it would take. And then at about 11 o'clock...
Iran has launched a direct attack from Iranian soil towards the state of Israel.
An Israeli military spokesman said that Iran had launched dozens of drones and they were heading towards Israel.
This is a severe and dangerous escalation. Our defensive and offensive capabilities...
The drones were on their way. But for hours, there was nothing to do but wait.
We entered this kind of weird limbo because drones don't actually fly that fast. Israel and Iran aren't direct neighbours, so there was going to be several hours before they arrived.
Then, as more than 300 drones and missiles filled the skies, Israel and its allies sprang into action, intercepting 99% before they reached their targets.
And so what we were seeing was not ballistic missiles landing, but ballistic missiles being taken down by air defences and then sort of fragments of shrapnel, fragments of missile falling across the sky.
By Sunday morning, the attacks were over and Israel was largely unscathed.
Just a few hours after, really, this had all happened, I went to a market in West Jerusalem, and business was pretty much as usual there. People were going about their daily lives.
Nobody was killed, but for the first time ever, Iran had launched a direct attack on Israeli territory. It marked a major escalation following decades of simmering tensions.
The Middle East is on the brink. The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict.
Israel's allies, and also its critics, are urging the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to show restraint, to take the successful defence as a win, as Joe Biden put it.
It's vital to avoid any action that could lead to major military confrontations on multiple fronts in the Middle East.
But will Israel listen? From The Guardian, I'm Helen Pidd. Today in Focus, how worried should we be about all-out war in the Middle East?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Emma, you're currently in Jerusalem. Can you tell us what happened on Saturday night?
So it was the first time there'd been a direct attack launched from Iranian soil at Israel. It was a massive attack. 300 drones, about 30 cruise missiles and 120 ballistic missiles. All these different types of weapons were timed to arrive at around the same time into Israeli airspace, so making it harder for Israel and its allies to shoot them all down and intercept them. There were also attacks coordinated with Iranian allies, a barrage of rockets into northern Israel, probably from Syria. There were attacks from the Houthis in Yemen and also attacks out of Iraq. But all of the drones and all of the cruise missiles were shot down before they even reached Israeli airspace. The only thing that got through were some of the ballistic missiles. And almost all of those were also intercepted. A few of them, the Israeli military said single digits, did make direct hits on an airbase in the Negev, the southern desert in Israel. But they did not cause major damage and the airbase continued operational throughout.
And did anybody get hurt?
So one person was hurt, a young girl who is from a Bedouin village, an unrecognised village in the desert near the airbase. This actually comes to a political controversy inside Israel because these villages are not recognised. They don't have air raid shelters. And so a bit of shrapnel fell through the roof of her house and she was injured by that and was in intensive care at a hospital getting treatment. Her family said she was hit on her head.
And how much warning was there of this attack?
By Saturday evening, it became increasingly clear. You'd had a couple of days of very serious American warnings that they had intelligence of a major attack. The Israeli military cancelled all public gatherings for 2 days. The Minister of Defense cancelled a planned trip to Europe. Then we heard that President Joe Biden had cancelled his beach weekend and was hurrying back to the White House by a helicopter. And then around 11 o'clock, it was clear that the attack was underway. And the moment of impact, the moment of greatest danger, was just a few hours away.
So what prompted Iran to launch this attack?
So on April 1st, Israel had launched a missile at a building next to the Iranian embassy in Damascus.
At least 5 people have been killed. Among the dead is a senior commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Several of the embassy's diplomats have also reportedly been killed in the attack. Iran's foreign minister says the Israeli attack is a breach of all international conventions.
There's been a long history of a shadow war between Iran and Israel, assassinations, other kinds of attacks. But this was seen as a sort of another level of escalation, not least because they were hitting diplomatic premises to take out this senior official. Mm-hmm. And there was a sense that if Iran didn't respond in quite a significant way, it would make its military presence in Syria, which it's invested a lot of money in, unsustainable, because it would essentially be giving Israel impunity to carry out these kind of assassinations at any time, at any point. When we spoke to academics who follow what's happening in Iran, they said they'd never seen the level of grassroots pressure on the Iranian government to respond and to respond forcefully to an Israeli attack as they were seeing in the wake of this assassination.
And given how unprecedented that Israeli attack was, like, what do you think Israel was hoping to achieve with it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So, you know, one Israeli military analyst who I spoke to said that part of Israel's problem in its dealings with the region is that it will organize and commission assassinations like this, attacks like this, without necessarily thinking about the strategic implications. So the general they took out was responsible for weapons transfers through Syria to Lebanon to Hezbollah, who are attacking North Israel. Israel would say they took out someone who was facilitating attacks on Israel, and by assassinating him, they were helping to protect the country. Critics, including inside Israel, would say that he will be replaced by someone else, and that it was an incredibly dangerous escalation at a time of perhaps unprecedented tensions, certainly unprecedented in decades, really, in this region. And that in that sense, it may have been tactically impressive, but was strategically risky or even reckless.
And can you help me understand the kind of history between Israel and Iran? They seem to have been playing tit for tat for a long time. Can you explain to us briefly why they've got such a fractious relationship?
Iran denies Israel's right to exist. Israel feels threatened by a ring of Iranian proxies, countries, militias that are backed, financed, supported by Iran and are extremely hostile to Israel. So, you know, that ranges from Hamas in Gaza, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, militias in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Of course, the state in Syria, you know, Bashar al-Assad has been reliant on, in no small part, on Iranian military and financial support to remain in power, to keep his regime going. So I think on both sides, there's a sense that this is a kind of almost an existential conflict.
Both Iran and Israel seem to be hailing Saturday's events as a success, but how is that possible?
Iran, for years, for decades, has followed a policy of what people have called strategic restraint. So in the face of Israeli attacks, it has not responded directly. I mean, this is partly perhaps a strategic move. It's gone for asymmetrical warfare, mobilizing some of its allies, its proxy forces. It's also a pragmatic approach because, you know, Iran clearly has a lot of pretty advanced weaponry, but the Iranian government knows that in a sort of head-to-head war with Israel, particularly with the US involved as Israel's closest ally, it's not going to win that war. Militarily, it's very much going to be on the back foot. So they were trying to do something that would show that they were still militarily a force to be reckoned with, while not making it impossible for Israel to sort of say, OK, we're going to leave it here. And if you look at what Iran did, yes, most of the missiles they sent were shot down, but some of the ballistic missiles did get through. And they got through an air defence mounted by Israel, the US, the UK, France, Jordan, you know, sort of some of the most powerful militaries in the world. And they did hit an airbase. Yes, they didn't do any direct damage, but they did manage to hit an airbase. So, you know, Iran showed that even with all the strength of Israel and its allies, they were still able to get ballistic missiles into Israeli airspace and were able to hit a military target, albeit not doing any damage. Israel, in turn, can say, you know, we face this fairly terrifying barrage of suicide drones, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles. We intercepted all of the cruise missiles and the drones, almost all of the ballistic missiles, and we had no significant military impact. We had one serious injury, which we are very concerned about, but not a single death. So, you know, that's how both sides are really able to claim success.
How significant is it that you had this coalition, the US, UK, Jordan even, all involved in helping Israel intercept the missiles and the drones?
But it's certainly very significant because, you know, that came at a time when Israel had been looking increasingly isolated over the way it was conducting its war in Gaza, the horrific levels of suffering there, the fact that you have either a looming famine or, according to, you know, the top US aid official, a famine already underway. And a week ago, the US-Israel relationship was looking very bad. Biden was sort of openly feuding with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, was putting huge pressure on the Israelis to let more aid into Gaza. There was quite serious discussion in America and the UK of potentially halting or reducing weapon sales to Israel because of the situation in Gaza. And, you know, overnight, those very public divisions were set to one side. And it became clear that, you know, when the chips were down, at least in terms of a confrontation between Israel and Iran, that Israel's allies, America and across Europe, would stand by it without question.
Mm-hmm. And so given that Israel successfully thwarted the attacks, the US has reconfirmed its commitment to supporting Israel. So could it all be viewed as a win for Netanyahu then?
Netanyahu's certainly in a less difficult position immediately than he was a week ago. But if you look at the bigger picture, there is still very serious concerns about escalation. There's factions within Netanyahu's own government who are pushing very hard to respond strongly, who don't say, Iran's responded, we've shown our defensive capacities, let's leave it there, which is what a lot of people want. They're saying, we've shown our military strength, we've shown how strong our alliances are, now's our chance to go after Iran. And an escalation to full-blown war, it's really hard to see how that would be in anyone's interest, except perhaps the hardliners who are pushing for it, because, you know, that would be an absolutely devastating conflict. So, I mean, Netanyahu's political position now is in the short term better than it was a week ago, but it's an incredibly dangerous moment for Israel, for the region, and possibly for the world. And I think it's worth noting that the US, in the wake of helping Israel manage its defence, they've said they will not take part in a counteroffensive against Iran, and said they really want to de-escalate regional tensions. They do not want a broader regional conflict. They've said it that plainly and clearly.
The president met with his national security team in the Situation Room for roughly 2 hours Saturday before a phone call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in which the president reaffirmed his commitment to Israel's security while making clear the U.S. will not participate in its response to Iran. Israeli officials now renew.
So you've got everybody from Joe Biden down kind of holding their breath, hoping that it's not going to escalate. But, as far as Iran is concerned, do you think it's done and dusted? They've made their point. End of story.
I mean, I think Iran has been very clear that they would like it to be finished, that they would like it, that they've managed this calibrated response to reestablish deterrence without doing anything that would force Israel to feel that they have to respond. They've said that if Israel responds with something aggressive, that their response to that would be much stronger than what we saw on Saturday. So I think everyone feels that the ball at this point is very much in Israel's court.
What do we know about what Israel is planning to do next?
Iran will face the consequences for its actions. We will choose our response accordingly.
So Israel is kind of weighing its response at the moment. So in the immediate aftermath of sort of Saturday night, on Sunday morning, the military said to us that they considered the use of ballistic missiles an escalatory factor. They've said that the leadership has approved both offensive and defensive action plans for a possible response to this. Benny Gantz, who's a member of the war cabinet and one of Netanyahu's main political rivals here, has said that Israel will exact a price from Iran when the time is right. And you have, you know, hardline far-right factions within the Israeli government, including, you know, ministers Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, who are pushing very hard for a strong response. And so I think at this point, there's certainly a large number of people in Israel who want this to be the end of this particular cycle. But there's other factions pushing for something that would escalate things. So it's not, I think it's not totally clear how that's going to play out yet.
From the perspective of the US, the UK and other allies, what's the worst case scenario? What's the worst thing that Israel could do in this scenario?
I mean, I think speculating about exact military actions is impossible. But I think, broadly speaking, the worst thing that Israel could do would be to respond to Iran's attack with something significant or damaging enough that Iran would feel compelled to respond more strongly to any escalatory attack from Israel. And then, you know, you start getting into this dangerous cycle.
I guess I was wondering about if they decided to go for Iran's nuclear infrastructure. That would feel pretty apocalyptic.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's, you know, for years, decades now, Israel has been concerned about Iran's attempt to get a nuclear program. Certainly, you know, it has this sort of fairly rogue nuclear project. But yeah, a military attack on nuclear facilities or perceived nuclear facilities would be very worrying, very inflammatory.
Mm-hmm. And do you think Israel actually wants an all-out war with Iran?
I mean, look, Israel's a democracy with a broad range of opinions. There's no question that there are people here who want an all-out war. They feel that Israel at the moment has an upper hand strategically, militarily, technically. Iran doesn't yet have a nuclear weapon. Now is the time to strike. You know, that kind of opinion. There's definitely a significant faction who want, if not war with Iran, at least want war with Hezbollah, you know, one of Iran's proxies in the north. But equally, there are many people here who share the concerns of many in America and other parts of the world about an escalation, about, you know, what that war on that scale would mean. You know, when I was sort of just going to talk to people on the streets on Sunday, that seemed to be very much the sentiment. You know, we're very relieved that the air defence system worked and we really hope this will be the end of it.
Coming up, with all eyes on Iran versus Israel, is there a risk that Gaza will be forgotten?
When our parents were our age, their lives looked a lot different than ours.
Young Australians are the first generation to be worse off than our parents. And we're told it's our fault.
But is it?
Who screwed millennials?
Not one person, not one place, not one bogeyman.
We're seeing a real shift in how we talk about economic instability and whose fault it is.
I'm Jane Lee.
And I'm Matilda Bosley. Listen to Who Screwed Millennials on Spotify or your favourite podcast player.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Emma, what does all of this mean for the war in Gaza?
So, I mean, that's a very good question. And I think, once again, you come back to the absolutely tragic situation for over 2 million people in Gaza. The USAID chief, Samantha Power, said she believed that famine was already underway in parts of Gaza. This time last week, you saw a real focus internationally on trying to get more aid into Gaza, you know, putting pressure on Israel to open up more aid routes, more access points, allow more food aid in. And Gaza just disappeared from the headlines. It's presumably disappeared largely from the rooms where Israeli and American officials are meeting because everybody's just talking about Iran. The Israeli military has just said that they're remobilizing soldiers, two battalions, to go back into Gaza. And, you know, the focus that you had on trying to reach a ceasefire deal, a hostage release deal, has once again been dissipated. So, you know, for civilians who are suffering in Gaza, this is tragic.
And final question. How worried should we be about a wider escalation?
I think it would be very foolish to dismiss the possibility of escalation. There are significant forces inside the Israeli government, inside Israel, who are pushing for a strong response, who would be open to a broader conflict. On the other hand, Iran has been quite clear that they are not looking for escalation, at least not of direct conflict. So I think while escalation is a very real and very terrifying possibility, there also are a lot of forces pushing to contain things. The problem is that, you know, sometimes people intentionally escalate things, but often it happens by accident. You have a tense situation, someone miscalculates, and it has unexpected consequences. You know, you could say for Israel, a recent example was the killing of 7 humanitarian workers with World Central Kitchen had massive consequences for the US-Israel relationship.
There's been international condemnation after the death of 7 aid workers in Gaza. The charity World Central Kitchen says their convoy was bombed in an Israeli airstrike just after they'd unloaded food from a warehouse.
It led to a shift in the way the humanitarian crisis inside Gaza was seen. And, you know, I'm almost certain that the officers who ordered the missile strikes on those World Central Kitchen cars would have no idea of what the fallout from their orders could be. And the potential with the Iranian-Israeli relationship is that you have some kind of miscalculation that leads to more violence, more death, more conflict. And that is really terrifying.
So it sounds like we've got some tense days and weeks ahead. Thank you so much, Emma, for talking to us today.
Thank you.
That's all for today. For all the latest on the Middle East, head to theguardian.com. Today's episode was produced by Eli Block and Alex Atak. It was presented by me, Helen Pidd, and executive produced by Homa Khalili. Sound design was by Rudy Zagadlo. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.